Namaskaram. My name is Nayad. I'm a tour leader with Explore. Come, follow me for a breakfast you will never forget. Namaste. Because you are going to make an incredible masala dosa under the watchful eye of my mom.
Kya baat hai, mom?
Each home adds their special touches. But not everyone gets to join in a traditional family meal. You will if you explore. For global adventures, search exploreworldwide.com. And don't just travel, explore!
In humanitarian contexts, in war zones, or on the ship, I think it is very important to be authentic, to really show the people, amidst that great, great suffering, that you are a fellow human and that you are with them.
Welcome to the Adventure Podcast and episode 80 with Sarah Sinkirova. Sarah is a Slovakian human rights journalist. Her work focuses on migration, human rights, humanitarian issues, and women's rights. In this episode, we talk about finding the balance between acting as a passive observer to difficult and often tragic situations, as well as showing compassion to people who are suffering. I can't help but explore the term adventure with Sarah, as well as talking about ethics and the human psyche. I also speak to her about her own heritage and how it might positively influence the work that she does, and how that might change the access that she has to the people whose stories she tells. And just quickly, we've had a few emails over the last little while about trigger warnings. We're in the middle of working out how we approach that sort of thing, because I decided to stop doing them a year or so ago after I read an article. In the meantime, I'm not going to go into the detail, but this episode is a heavy one. It's serious, it's real, and I'm sure you can imagine the sort of avenues we might walk down given Sarah's work. But on the flip side, it is immensely positive and hopeful, and Sarah is an inspiration. Okay, and if you've decided to stay, before we begin, I'd like to point you towards the Martin Moran Foundation, our charitable partner. As I've said before, they're an amazing organisation and their mission is to get people out into the hills, the mountains, and to help people discover and live a life full of adventure. It's an initiative very close to my heart and I'd be really grateful if you were able to support their work. Also, if you're enjoying the Adventure Podcast, we're 80 episodes in now, so please do subscribe. If you've been with us since the start, then thank you so much. And if you haven't, then there's 80 episodes for you to go and listen to. And if you're subscribing and listening on iTunes, then an honest review would also be amazing. Subscribing and reviewing helps us with visibility and helps bring more people to the podcast. Finally, the podcast is produced alongside Sidetrack Magazine, our spiritual sister publication. So if you're enjoying the podcast and want a written and photographic adventure fix, then head to sidetrack.com. Okay, over to Sarah Sinkirova. I guess a logical place to start is if you could just introduce yourself. Who are you? What do you do? Why are we having this conversation?
Right. All these questions. So I'm a human rights journalist. I'm a freelance journalist. And I originally come from Slovakia. So right now I'm recording this podcast from my home in Bratislava. And I've been covering human rights and humanitarian issues and women's rights around the world for the last maybe 7 or 8 years. And as I was saying, I originally come from Slovakia and I left my home when I was 15. I used to live in France and in the UK and around the world working for NGOs. And then at one point I decided I wanted to document stories that matter. And, you know, I was very lucky because at that time I was working in Africa, I was in Asia. Later on, I used to work with the victims of domestic violence in the UK as well as a support worker and as a researcher. And then from there, I decided I wanted to become more of a journalist and I started covering humanitarian stories. And I've worked in many, many different countries since, in Ukraine, Georgia, Belarus, Uganda, Rwanda, Morocco. And I've recently spent 4 weeks on a refugee rescue boat on the in the Mediterranean on the CI4. And I participated in the rescue of 408 refugees that we rescued in May 2021. So that's about it, my story in short.
It sounds like there's a much longer version for us to unpack there.
Definitely.
So let's stick to the start. So why did you, or where did you go, I guess, when you were 15, and what was the motivation, and what were you trying to do?
Yeah, so I think this is, you know, the fact that I'm from Slovakia is also one of the reasons why I'm so interested in covering migration and refugee stories, right? Because I was born right after the Velvet Revolution, and, you know, what I saw growing up in Eastern Europe, in Czechoslovakia in the 90s, and later in Slovakia, was that people were really so keen to travel and really, you know, wanted to discover the world and discovered the Western countries for sure. And I certainly grew up, you know, in that atmosphere of people just being really, really kind of euphoric about the future for a while. At least that's what I was perceiving as a child, because everyone was telling me, you know, you were born in this happy period where you are free to travel. And I was very lucky, I guess, and I was able to move to France at first when I was 15 to study in a high school in France, which is where I've lived for the next 7 or 8 years. And I studied communications, and from there I was very lucky as well, because I knew at a very young age that I wanted to be a journalist or make documentary films. And from there I went to work in many other countries and pursuing human rights projects, and then ultimately became a journalist.
Wow. Yeah, that is, it sounds like you had it worked out fairly early on.
I did.
So what did you do when you graduated? What was the plan?
I was studying in Paris, and I was studying communications, and for my final internship that I had to do in my second year of master's degree, I went to Indonesia to work for the French Institute. And that was when I kind of discovered, you know, the world of traveling and adventure as well, other than just, you know, working in communications. And also became really interested in human stories, which, I mean, I've always been interested in. And I think, you know, an interesting thing to say is that when I first arrived in France, I was, you know, I was very young, I was a teenager, and I was living at the time with a host family, and that host family was from Algeria, so they were themselves immigrants, right? And they really, you know, received me with so much kindness and hospitality, and I've always been very, very interested in covering stories about migration. And then obviously when I was in Indonesia, and later on when I graduated, I went to Burkina Faso, to Africa, to work as an editor for an NGO. Actually, I was editing kind of communications and educational text, because it was actually an educational institution. I was just really interested in, you know, in the human stories. And what happened in Indonesia, not as much, but when I was in Burkina Faso, I was very young, I was 22, and what happened was that around that time the war of the military intervention in Mali happened, and it was kind of unfolding, and I was in Ouagadougou in working in, you know, in Burkina Faso, and all of a sudden we started seeing these refugees coming in from Mali. And so that was, I guess, the first time I was kind of confronted, you know, with seeing at the time, and maybe starting to document not just, you know, human stories, but stories of migrants and refugees. And then later on, I returned back to Slovakia, to my home country. And then the war in Ukraine broke out in 2014. And so that was, I think, the first kind of conflict that I started to cover, not really going to the conflict zone, but again, you know, covering the stories of the internally displaced persons. And that's how it all began.
Well, it sounds like it got very serious very quickly.
It has, yeah, definitely. And then I think once you start doing doing this amazing job, and obviously it's very hard to start off as a freelance writer, but once you start documenting these stories and once you kind of interact with those people, it's just, for me, I kind of knew that was my mission and what I wanted to do the most. And as I've mentioned, I think I was very lucky because I was born in the right place in the right time, right? Because I was born in Eastern Europe, but I was born right after the fall of the communist regime. But oftentimes I have been thinking about, what my life would have been like if I was born like 10 years, 20 years, prior or even later. And so sometimes when I see people fleeing from humanitarian crises, I kind of, I also see, the history unfolding, and I also kind of perceive it through my own lens, thinking about, I was lucky to be born in the right place in the right time, but if it could have been very different. And at that time, the world was kind of more divided into East and West. And I was on the less privileged side, and today we kind of tend to talk more about North and South. And again, when I see the stories of refugees, to me, it maybe feels a bit different than it, that it maybe would to somebody who's from a Western country.
Yeah, I think it's really interesting because the natural place for me to go here is to talk about Africa and talk about, the migrant boats and things like that. But actually, as we talk, I realize my own kind of naivety around somewhere like Slovakia. I know very little about that place. I mean, it would almost be interesting to hear from you, what's it like? What was it like growing up there? And now that you're well traveled, what's it like looking back at it from a well traveled perspective?
Well, as I said, I just, for me personally, covering these stories, having covered so many humanitarian issues, I just, keep thinking about how privileged I was. I think, for me, the way I remember it is obviously probably very different to what it really was for people, because I was a kid, and memory is not really accurate, right? So for me, the way I remember my childhood was that people were coming out of something very, very difficult, of horrible years of a dictatorship, and then all of a sudden, at the beginning of the 90s, they felt free, right? They had this kind of, that's what I remember, that's the, my parents, my family, the people I was growing up with, that's what they were telling me. They were very kind of, euphoric about the future. They were very naive in a way, because they thought that now everything has opened up and everything would be easy. And they had a lot of kind of, these, dreams and idealistic, visions of what life would be like in Western Europe. And to be honest, sometimes when I listen to refugees, coming from Africa, for example, and they tell me about what they had imagined for themselves, I kind of, to me, it almost feel like, it must have been similar in Eastern Europe, I think, at that time. And obviously, once you migrate, once you make that journey oftentimes was, very difficult, both for immigrants from Eastern Europe, and it's just extremely difficult for, for refugees from Africa. And I think we will talk about that a bit later in the podcast. But to me, that's definitely, something that I have been thinking about a lot. And the fact that, as I said, I was, when I was little, I was, from the, I remember we were traveling actually a lot with my family, and we actually went to the UK, and this was in the early 90s, must have been in 94 or 95. And I think, at that time we were the weird people from Eastern Europe. I remember, how weird it felt, and how difficult it was to get the visa and to even go, to the UK for a vacation. And then I actually haven't done anything. And I myself, you know, as a child, when I was 14 when Slovakia joined the EU, when I was 15 when I moved to France, I haven't really done anything, and yet I have this incredible privilege, you know, that now I'm part of the EU. And to me, you know, seeing how badly Europe treats refugees and migrants today is just heartbreaking. And I really kind of keep reminding myself of how privileged I am and, you know, how different it was at the time. And I think that kind of helps me build maybe a more, I don't want to say maybe a deeper connection, but there is something to my story that really makes my reporting maybe even kind of maybe stronger or deeper, because I feel that connection with the refugees.
I was just about to ask that. It seems really apparent that your kind of cultural ancestry and the place that you're from allows you to connect with these people in a way that I would really struggle to do with my British passport, my ex-EU status, and my, you know, East of England culture and heritage. So yeah, it's quite obvious that, and the way that you speak about it, you know, I can see you, obviously people listening to this can't, but you speak about that so passionately, it seems to be a fairly big part of who and what you are.
Definitely, you know, I'm, you know, when it comes to journalism, I, you know, all of a sudden I become this very, very passionate person. And, you know, I'm this reporter who's kind of out in the field and, you know, I'm ready to die for my story. And I'm ready to, you know, to go anywhere and to do anything, because it's so important to me. But it's not just because, you know, I'm from Slovakia or from Eastern Europe and I have this, you know, historical kind of heritage, but also because defending human rights is so important to me. And, you know, I have seen so many human rights violations. And again, you know, it's also part of, you know, what Czechoslovakia and Eastern Europe, you know, have been through. And obviously, you know, we can definitely look at it from the historical perspective. But also, you know, when I see the human rights abuses, and also because I've worked for a domestic violence shelter for 2 years, and, you know, I've worked for many different women's NGOs, I'm also very sensitive to these human stories. And I'm just, you know, I'm just this passionate, but, you know, and slightly naive reporter who will always defend human rights.
No, I don't think it's naive, but I think we'll come on to all of that a bit later. So. Sure. Yeah, I mean, I think you said it was Mali that was your first kind of experience of, well, those human rights violations and those really displaced people. Can you talk to me about that experience, what it was like, what happened, and how it shaped you?
So I was actually in Burkina Faso and I was seeing, you know, the refugees coming. And I remember one day I was going back home from work, and there was this refugee from Mali who had, I don't know how long actually he had been in Burkina Faso at that point. And I think he just saw me, you know, he saw that obviously, you know, I was a white woman, and he came to me and he was crying and he was just, you know, begging for help. And at that time, you know, I was 22 and, you know, and I was just, I remember that was such a strong encounter with human suffering and, you know, displacement. And also I had a lot of colleagues from Mali at the time who all of a sudden became kind of very worried for their families. And yes, I guess, you know, it was there and then that I kind of somehow start, you know, I was beginning to understand that this was what I wanted to do, that I wanted to write about it. And obviously I was very young, I didn't quite know how to go about it. And then later on, the following year, I was in Slovakia for a short period of time. And when the war in Ukraine broke out, I remember thinking, because, you know, when you are in Africa and you are from a European country, the fact that there is a war going on nearby or in your neighboring country, at the time, to me, that sounded very strange. It, at that time in 2012, 2013, would have sounded crazy to me if you know, if you told me that I would go back to my home country and there a war would unfold in my neighbouring country. You know, it was very difficult for me to, you know, and for anyone, I guess, in Europe. And then when I moved back to Slovakia, you know, the war in Ukraine broke out, and all of a sudden I thought, even though, you know, geographically it's in eastern Ukraine, so it's still very, very far away, I thought to myself, it's crazy, right, that you know, there is a war going on in my neighbouring country, and, you know, I have to go there and have to interview the people who fled. And again, I was confronted with that huge amount of suffering and people crying. And it, you know, it's funny because I had just returned to eastern Ukraine. I was there in August, like a month ago, and the war is still going on, and I have seen so much suffering, you know, on the front line of eastern Ukraine. And, you know, and I had interviewed people, you know, and this 7 years later, and this is still going on, and people live there in destroyed houses. And we could maybe even talk about that if you want. I know it's not the refugee rescue boat story, but again, you know, it's just incredible, and also very sad to see that so many of these humanitarian tragedies of our time kind of go on and on and on. And I think the same goes for, you know, migration to Europe. That is not over, and we could still see these tragic stories going on.
Yeah, and I think if you're happy to, I think we should talk about it, because it's a good example of the kind of conflict or the kind of issue where it hits the news, it's current for a while, and then it goes and it's gone. And, you know, I'm very happy to admit that I haven't thought about there being a war in Ukraine for a long time, because I'm not exposed to it.
Definitely. And, you know, not even like people in Slovakia, I think I'm not exposed to it. And, you know, and as I said, it's our neighbouring country. And I think this is one of the quote-unquote frozen conflicts, the so-called frozen conflicts. I wouldn't call it that, but obviously the fighting is kind of sporadic, and so there hasn't, you know, been many stories recently, you know, and especially not stories documenting the lives of people. And to me, I was on the front line, and when I was visiting the people who live on the contact line, that, you know, the front line, I was embedded for a few days with people in need, with a Czech NGO, and I had interviewed some of the people that they had been helping, and it was mainly the elderly people and disabled people. And, you know, what we see, and this is one of the things that is kind of very typical of eastern Ukraine, is that unfortunately the percentage of people who remained living on, you know, on the contact line, it's mainly, you know, the elderly people or disabled people or people who are somehow vulnerable, so they were not able to kind of move away. And really, it's, you know, it's mostly the elderly. And it was, you know, I've seen the most incredibly tragic images. I remember the first person we went to interview was this old lady who was in her 70s, I think, and who is a wheelchair user. She has mobility issues. She cannot move at all, actually. She has very, very limited kind of mobility. And she lives around 5 kilometers away from the contact line, so she can still hear shooting at night. But she's not like directly exposed, as in, you know, some people are really living in, you know, at the contact line itself. But she lives in this very old house, and I remember when we entered the house, it was really hot. The house was kind of, you know, destroyed in a way, and really old, and the front door would not close, and the lady had this kind of a rope attached to it. And as we entered, she was sitting on her bed, and she was trying to move from her bed to kind of sit onto the wheelchair, but she couldn't lift herself up because she was too weak. And, you know, and it looked so sad, because, you know, it's a house with an open door, and, you know, in the middle of the war zone, and this old lady who cannot move. And we entered the house and we said hello, and we wanted to help her, but she didn't want to be helped. And I thought, oh my God, this lady, she's going to be so angry at us, right? Because we just came in such a delicate moment, when really kind of she turned to us and she was like the kindest person I've ever seen. And she started telling me and the lady who was with me, she was like, hello, you are my dearest children and I love you. And it's so nice that you came to talk to me. And she was just so kind, you know, and so happy and very kind of connected, had a very kind of deep, you know, spiritual connection. And she was telling us that when she hears shooting and shelling, she prays for the soldiers who do that, because she thinks, you know, that they don't know what they are doing. And the reason why she has a rope attached to her front door is that when they are, you know, when there is bombings and shellings, the door kind of, it kind of hits the door and it opens it, right? And she cannot move all the way to the door because she can barely move. And so the only way for her to close her door is to kind of pull on that rope and close the door from her bedroom. And on the one hand, you know, it's so tragic. And then on the other hand, you see this incredible kind of kindness and spirituality and resilience of the local people. And, you know, and as usual with humanitarian journalism, you bump into the most incredible stories and you see the greatest kind of cruelty and pain. And you also see the incredible kindness and resilience and, you know, these people who were really like, you know, behaving like, all these old ladies were behaving like my grandma and just, you know, hugging me and kissing me and, you know, wanting to give me, well, anything they had. And as they usually don't have anything, they would, you know, give me apples or tomatoes from their garden and all of this, you know, in the midst of the war zone.
It's crazy to think it's happening. And I mean, it might be worth, actually, if you're happy to, giving a bit of context on what is happening. Like, why is the conflict still going on?
Well, as I said, you know, it's one of the conflicts that is, you know, a so-called frozen conflict. So it began in 2014 in May, but the conflict is still going on. So it is still active. And as I've mentioned, there's been a massive, massive displacement crisis following, you know, the events of 2014 and the Euromaidan and then the beginning of the war and the towns of Slavyansk, that town has been destroyed. And obviously the most dramatic events kind of happened around 2014, 15, 16. And then most of the people who were able to flee fled. At the time, unless I don't have the exact number in front of me, but I think it was around 2 million internally displaced persons. But what kind of is still going on is that the territory is still divided. So there is, that's what, you know, when we say the contact line, it's actually the line that marks the self-proclaimed kind of separatist regions around the towns of Donetsk and Luhansk. And I was actually monitoring the situation from the other side. So I was in the government controlled areas. But the contact line obviously is still, it's still a little bit like an open conflict, if you will. There's snipers, there's explosive remnants of war. For me, what was very surprising is that obviously it must be very hard for local people to see that their country, the place where they live, has been divided like that in two, and you know, some villages kind of have the contact line in the middle of it, and people who were living there kind of live on a contact line that they cannot cross because they would probably die, they would probably be shot at. I remember that when I was in the zone, I was actually speaking with the people, you know, in those villages, and I was asking, are you not angry? Like, you know, I would certainly be angry and frustrated if this happened in my town or in the place where I lived, and they said, it's been going on for 7 years. So, what really kind of happens there and unfolds there is that people have to live, in a very kind of sad place, and most of them are depressed and they do not have the energy to be angry anymore.
No. And so what is it you're trying to say with your work out there?
Well, to me personally, I always try to show the human stories of the people who live there and their incredible kindness and resilience and humanity, really. And also to say that, this conflict should not be forgotten. And also to say that the war is still going on. So a house was shelled on the 5th of August when I was there in a town of Krasnohorivka. Recently, two soldiers were killed. So even though the fighting is what people call sporadic, it's still going on, and it's so important not to forget, and also to humanize history and humanize these stories and these conflicts through, what the people tell me. And this, I guess, is the same as, what I try to do when I report on migration, and, particularly when you report about migrants and refugees arriving into the EU. And, and as a journalist, I've been confronted with so many hate comments and people kind of really dehumanizing refugees. And I think it's very important to keep telling these human stories, to try and give these people a little bit of dignity and to show that they are the same humans as we are. And, when I was in Ukraine and I saw these old ladies, these babushkas, I was like, to me, they are like my grandma, right? And this is what I kind of tend to feel, and when you see children, you kind of care about children as though, it were your children. It's like, it's like everyone's children, right? You cannot dehumanize them. And I felt the same way with the old ladies. I kind of tried, and I have these really personal feelings also about people that I report on. I try not to see them as objects, but rather as though they were my family members or my friends, to show that they have this kind of intrinsic human value, if that makes sense, if that doesn't sound too crazy.
No, it makes total and complete sense, and it's the perfect segue, because I was going to ask you, like, there's dozens of books written on this subject, but the ethics of it are really interesting, I think, because, don't worry, I'm fully on your team here, but it's the whole, as a photographer, but it's that difficult line of wanting to tell someone's story and give them dignity, while simultaneously there's a voyeuristic element to taking their photograph or being in the old lady's house when she's trying to get out of the wheelchair. So, you're clearly much more qualified and clued up on it than I am. Can you tell me a bit about the ethics of that style of work?
Well, I think this is the core of human rights journalism. I think, when you're a human rights journalist, you keep asking yourself those questions all the time. And that is like 99% of your work to me. It's all about those, ethics and ethical questions. And there's so many different opinions on it, because, some people could also argue that it's not good to being too attached, to say that when I see this old lady, I cannot think of, I have to think of my grandma and try to kind of approach her with that same respect and tenderness, I guess. But to me, I think in humanitarian contexts, in war zones or on the ship, I think it is very important to be authentic. So to really show the people, amidst that great, great suffering, that you are a fellow human and that you are with them, that you really have that compassion. Obviously, I think it's very different when you are interviewing someone, in a cafe in the UK or in Slovakia, and you should be able to keep that journalistic distance. But I think when you are in a war zone and you see a lady who cannot move, or when you are on the ship and, you know, all of a sudden the rescue team kind of gives you, you know, small children and babies, and they all want to hug you, and because that's what happened to us on the ship. I think in those cases, I think you should just be very authentic and kind of fully human, and really treat them, you know, treat these people as your, you know, close people, because this is what they need. And to me, that in those moments, that's even more important than being, you know, a journalist, is just being a compassionate fellow human. Because I think if you try to be kind of very professional or very journalistic and just, you know, take that picture or ask the question and leave, you will traumatize the people, right? And, you know, as they say in journalism, you can either become part of the trauma or part of the healing. You know, I always try to become part of the healing. But at the same time, as you said, you know, it's very complicated. And certainly, for example, I had worked with victims of violence, domestic violence, violence against women. And for example, when you work with that group, it might be very difficult to approach them. For example, you know, you have to be very mindful of your distance, and, you know, not everyone wants to be touched or hugged, you know, even in a way that you would normally touch people. But at the same time, for example, when I was on the ship, we had a lot of, we've actually rescued 36 women and 150 children, and most of them had been through horrible abuse, and especially the women, who, most of whom had been raped. And yet they still wanted to, I think, they wanted to be hugged, they wanted to be listened to. And I think it's a very delicate balance of, you know, trying to be authentic, not kind of trying to always be mindful of their dignity, but also be mindful of what they want. And, you know, and I think it would be inhumane in that situation to, for example, to refuse to hug them, right? But it's always a very, you know, delicate balance of what you can do, you know, when you should stop. And as I said, for me, this is like the core of human rights journalism, and, you know, the questions that you have to question yourself all the time. And I think as long as you question yourself, you are probably doing it right. You know, when you become too sure of what you do, then either there might be a problem, right? That's how I see it. But I don't know what your point of view is. You can also share your thoughts as a journalist and photographer.
No, I think it's, you know, listening to you speak so passionately about it, I think it's really hard to argue with you. I mean, as I said, there are dozens of books written on the subject, and some people think you should keep your distance and some people think you should get in close. I don't feel qualified to have a strong opinion about it, but what I do know of me is that your intention is 100% pure. You know, what you're trying to do to me sounds so real and honest that it's hard to criticize. So no, I think it's wonderful. I mean, what I want to ask you is how this affects you and how you guard yourself from being too affected by it.
Yeah, this is a question I get asked a lot. Like, this is, and I think for all of the, you know, when I talk about the rescue operation aboard the CI-4, this is what I get asked all the time, and what all the rescue team members, you know, get asked all the time. To me, I mean, when I talk about the rescue operation aboard the CI-4, I always say that at the end we were all very happy because everyone survived. So obviously, you know, that is one thing, is that when you cover stories where, you know, everyone is safe and well, and, you know, that experience of, you know, interviewing these people or being with them is kind of positive, it can be a very good experience. And I guess for me, the way I handle it is that I try to just be very authentic and be there with the people. So I really try to show them that, you know, of course I'm a journalist, I, you know, that there are certain boundaries, but, you know, I'm their friend, I'm there to listen to their stories, to give them a voice, to show them compassion, because I believe that's part of, you know, humanity is part of, you know, the core principles of ethical journalism. And I guess to me, that's, you know, that's also a way of kind of protecting myself, or finding meaning in what I do is that even though it can be very difficult at times, you know, I'm also there to show, you know, that compassion to the people. And I think it oftentimes it can also be a good experience for them. But obviously, you know, there are certain tragedies that, you know, journalists witness, like, you know, for example, all the journalists and the rescue crews that, you know, were doing rescues in the Mediterranean and found, you know, empty boats and boats with, you know, where people had died and drowned. Obviously, that's, you know, a different situation. And luckily for me, you know, I haven't been through that. But again, you know, I think that's a different story, and that must be, you know, much, much, much harder.
Yeah. God, it's hard to imagine. Yeah. So I guess we should talk about CI4, I suppose.
I think it would be nice to say a few words about it.
We've got a lot of time, so we're all good. So how did it come about, and what was your motivation and inspiration for going?
Yeah, so I've been covering, you know, many different stories about migration, and I've also worked in Morocco and Spain and you know, and at the time in Burkina Faso, so I was kind of familiar with the routes and the trajectories. And I had also worked with refugees in Greece, documenting their stories. And I had always been, you know, at least in the recent years, I've been very passionate about trying to monitor the situation in the Mediterranean and trying to kind of find out what happens there and how many people really drown, because that's, you know, another big question as a journalist is that there is a certain lack of data. We will never know exactly how many, you know, people die there. And I think this is one of the biggest, you know, humanitarian tragedies of our time, and something we will have to explain to our children and grandchildren. And I really hope they will, you know, ask us these questions and hold us accountable. And it's quite difficult actually to get on board a ship, because obviously there's a lot of journalists who want to do it. And I had collaborated a little bit with CEI, you know, quoting them and interviewing them and speaking with them for different stories that I had been working on. And then what happened actually is that I was not the journalist who was supposed to be going on the CI4 mission. I think they've had another journalist, and then, you know, it kind of changed or got cancelled. And, you know, there's been a lot of changes in the crewing. And then I got a last minute call, and I got a last minute call at the end of April saying, would you be interested in covering, you know, in coming aboard the CI4 and in covering the rescue? If so, we will wait for you in, you know, 6 days from now in the port of Buriana, and, you know, we are sailing off at 8 o'clock, and if you're interested, just be on the ship by that time. And they even said that, you know, obviously with the quarantines and the, you know, the standoffs and everything that's going on, you know, it can be very difficult to wait for a port of safety. It can take up to 6 weeks. So you have to be ready to kind of, you know, embark on this adventure, as, you know, I guess, and just not knowing when exactly you'll be back. And, you know, you know, I'm a crazy passionate journalist, so I just left everything I was doing, and I just bought my safety shoes, and I just went to Buriana, and I embarked, and I guess it was like the best thing I've ever done. But yeah, it was on a short notice for sure. And then we embarked, and we spent 4 weeks aboard the ship, you know, with the quarantine. And it was, I think, the biggest rescue that CI, the NGO CI, has ever seen. We had rescued 408 people, out of whom 406 were rescued in only 20 hours of time from 5 different boats in distress. So it was like, you know, the craziest kind of rescue operation. I don't know if craziest is the right word, but the busiest. It started, these 5 rescues in 20 hours of time started on the 16th of May at 3:06 in the afternoon, and then continued. We rescued two boats in distress at 3 p.m., then another one around 5 p.m., then another one between midnight and 3 a.m., and then at the last boat at around 10 a.m. the next morning. And we ended up with a deck, you know, full of people, including 150 children, as I've mentioned. And, you know, all of this happened in such a short period of time, but I think it was an amazing experience and everyone survived. So we were so happy in the end.
Yeah, it's unbelievable.
It's unbelievable. But
then, yeah, almost literally. And what I'm really interested in is what life was like on the boat before that happened, because of the stark contrast, you know, the anticipation, and I genuinely mean the lifestyle, you know, living on a small boat.
This is such an interesting question, because I never thought about that, but you are completely right. There was this, it was an incredible experience in terms of social psychology, I guess, because we, when we embarked, we, you know, we were 23 crew members, and the atmosphere was kind of, you know, there was a, you know, I don't want to call it an adventure, but in a way it was a small adventure, right? Even though, you know, obviously, you know, it was not an expedition you do for yourself. It was something you do to help other people. But obviously, you know, it was a big journey for all of us. And there is a lot of training involved. So we did a lot of trainings at first, and particularly the medical and the first aid trainings. But the first days were kind of unfolding in a very kind of peaceful and happy atmosphere. And then as we sailed off, as we were approaching the Libyan search and rescue zone, it took us around 4 or 5 days to get to that zone. You could tell that little by little the atmosphere kind of changed. And, you know, I remember prior to that we were playing cards, and, you know, and we were having a good time together. And I think it's very important, because we all knew we were going to face something potentially very difficult that could have even, like, you know, involved, you know, finding people who had drowned. And so it's very important, I think, to build those relationships with your crew members, and, you know, also be able to laugh together and to, you know, share those moments together. But little by little, as we were approaching the search and rescue, the SAR zone, the atmosphere got so tense, and everyone started going to bed really early at night. It was like 8 p.m. and everyone was going to bed. And, you know, at one point I remember with my cabin mate, we went to bed. This was after we had arrived in the search and rescue zone. We knew the weather conditions were good, and we actually went to bed. And I think we were kind of, she was part of the rescue team, and she was kind of wearing her rescue, you know, special equipment, you know, clothes. And I had this little paper, and where I had written the instructions for how many, you know, chest compressions and ventilations you have to give to people who are drowning, not drowning, children, adults. And we were kind of having that on us when we went to sleep, because we knew that we could be woken up by the alarm at any time, you know, at night, and had to be ready to be, you know, rescuing people. And at that time, it was suddenly everything became very different. And also, I think for me, I know it might sound a little dramatic, but there was that, you know, theme of death and, you know, despair. For me, it was something that, you know, you could feel in the air. And of course, once you arrive into the search and rescue zone, you may come across, you know, seeing, I don't know, a life vest in the water or something like that. And you know where you are. You know that you are in a desperate zone where people drown, where people try to cross every day, where people, you know, suffer from unimaginable suffering, you know, aboard these tiny wooden boats, you know, suffering from hypothermia and, you know, and with the sun hitting them. And you just know that you are in a very sad place. And so the adventure all of a sudden became very different, at least to me.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
So what's it like when the alarm goes off and everything changes?
The good thing is that we had trained that many times. That's, you know, really important, is that you know exactly what to do. And the first time we were confronted with a distress call was actually, it was, I think, the first day when we had just arrived into the search and rescue zone. And the, I think it was the first officer, he came to the mess room, and we were actually having lunch, and he said, you know, there is a distress call that we, I think the distress call came from an organization called the Alarm Phone that receives distress calls from satellite phones and from you know, people aboard the wooden boats. And we were told that there was a distress call for, you know, for, it was about regarding a ship, that a wooden boat with many women and children aboard. But it was very, very far away from us. It was 16 hours away from us if we went there full speed. And that was the first, I think, time when we were confronted with the fact that even though you are there, obviously the search and rescue zone is really, really big, right? It's, you know, that is technically the search and rescue zone. But because there is no kind of European operation, there is no, I mean, there is the Libyan Coast Guard that takes people back to Libya where they are being put in detention centres. So that's the worst fear for all the refugees. But there is no one really to rescue the people and take them to a safe place. And so this, you know, this incredibly big search and rescue zone is only being patrolled by small, you know, civil search and rescue NGOs like CI and many others. At that time, we were the only one, the only rescue ship in the whole zone. The Sea Watch was there about 3 weeks before us, and then the Itamari came after us. But at the time, we were the only ones. And it's just this crazy feeling that you are in this, you know, immense zone and you just can't make it on time, right? 16 hours, that's just, you know, that's too long for a boat in distress, and, you know, with people drowning. And it was a horrible feeling. I remember, you know, we couldn't eat, and all of a sudden, like, you know, the room went kind of silent. And what happened is that a few hours later, we were informed that this wooden boat was actually taken back to Libya by the Libyan Coast Guard. So they were likely put back into a detention center where, you know, the most horrific human rights violations happen, and, you know, where women are being raped and where children don't get food. But at the same time, you know, they didn't drown. So that's, you know, and that's something that happens to you when you're a sea rescue person, is that you see people, you hear about people being deported back to Libya. And then we had also found an empty boat that was, you know, a few hours later. That, and again, we are pretty sure it was a boat that had been evacuated by the Libyan Coast Guard, because we haven't found any bodies, but it was just a boat and there were just, you know, things on it, like clothes and so on, but it was empty. So for us, we knew that these people were kind of deported back to Libya. And then we rescued one small fiberglass boat with two people on it. And then a day or two later, we actually spotted two boats what we thought were two boats in distress, because that's another thing, is that when you spot the boats from, you know, from the ship, you obviously were doing the SAR watches with the binocular, but it's obviously very far away, so sometimes you are not able to tell 100%. And we spotted two refugee boats in distress. There were 177 people approximately on board the two boats. We rescued them, and then four other boats followed, you know, within less than 20 hours. So, you know, this is how it goes, I think, with sea rescue, and this is how it went for us. And so from that moment on, we didn't have time to think. We were just too busy rescuing people and then, you know, caring for the people.
Yeah, and there's definitely a few questions I want to ask about that. But the first thing is, what happened to you as a team of rescuers? So obviously with the tragedy of not being able to go the 16 hours, but then obviously the joy surrounding the rescues, you arrived as strangers on that boat, right?
We did, yeah, we didn't know each other. I think we really bonded. I think we really went, you know, we really got on really, really well. So it's definitely, you know, a journey that you will never forget. So I think we will always, you know, share those memories, and, you know, and we definitely bond with, you know, your crew members. But this, you know, interestingly enough, this happens to me with, you know, with other human rights stories I cover as well. You know, when you meet the people that were with you on that reporting trip, and you know, then you don't see them, and then you see them, say, a year or two, you know, down the road. It's always such a strong kind of feeling of, you know, an emotion of seeing those people. So I think it would be the same. Obviously, we come from many different countries. But I think, you know, if we meet again one day, or if we kind of bump into each other, we will definitely have that, you know, bond forever, I think.
Yeah. It's funny, isn't it? You've said this a few times throughout this conversation, but you said it was an adventure, and then you said, well, was it an adventure? Should it be? And I think, I don't know, these terms don't necessarily matter, but equally, I think it was adventurous, right?
Definitely. I mean, the reason why I'm kind of reluctant to call it an adventure is that obviously it's, you know, it shouldn't be. It's not something you should do because you are adventurous and then you are looking for something, you know, exciting to do. It's, you know, it's something that I think everyone should do. It's not even something I think you should feel, you know, proud of yourself for, because it's something that's normal, and we should all make sure that, you know, people who are drowning are being rescued. But at the same time, obviously, you know, it's a personal journey. You will have to kind of, you know, push your limits and work really hard. And so in that respect, it you know, I think it is an adventure from a personal psychological point of view for each and every one of us.
Yeah, I agree. And the reason I go on about it, and it's probably worth me clarifying this, you know, for you and other people, is I just think we need to make sure we're living adventurous lives, and that's a personal thing, and it doesn't mean we need to shout about how brave we are. It's more of a living with intent and being brave and stepping out of our comfort zones and being purposeful and being willing to say, oh, I'm not sure I can do that, but I think I'll try. And it sounds like you do a lot of that, and you seem like a very purposeful person.
Thank you. Well, I agree with you. You know, I think it's really important to do something. And this is something that I've learned as a journalist, is that it is very difficult if you want to cover humanitarian issues. It's always very difficult, you know, to gain access to kind of get to these people, whether it's, you know, a refugee camp or a border or, a place, or, you know, the middle of the Mediterranean. It's always very hard to, there's always a lot of difficulties, but it's definitely worth it. And I think people should not be stopped by those difficulties, by the fact that, you know, doing a reporting trip, or even, you know, going somewhere as a volunteer or an NGO worker, it's always going to be difficult, right? And as a journalist, you know, people are afraid of journalists. There's countries where you cannot go as a journalist. But it's always going to be very difficult for journalists, but it's definitely worth it. And, you know, we shouldn't be stopped by the fact that there are many difficulties, and especially not when it comes to defending human rights or rescuing people, you know.
Yeah. How could anyone argue with that?
Well, you know, I was very surprised, because what happened to me was that I've covered the rescue, you know, for many different media outlets, and I mostly write in English, but I've done a few stories in Slovakia and in the Czech Republic, and it was so sad to see that I have received, you know, so much hate mail and comments, and in my stories I was highlighting the stories of the women and the children and the fact that we had 19 infants and we were changing nappies and making baby food and playing with the kids, because that's what we were doing, you know, once we had all the children on board. And yet, you know, when people read my stories, that I've received so many comments and so much email, you know, even like directed to my personal email address, saying that I was making it up, that these children were, you know, adult men, and that, you know, I've received so many really horrific comments, and that really makes you question, you know, humanity, because it's like, how can someone argue with that when really, you know, your reality as a rescuer is that you are there and you see all these people, and, you know, so many of them were in bad condition and fainting, and we had one 8-year-old dehydrated boy who probably would have died if he had stayed on the wooden boat, because he was suffering from severe hypothermia. And then you are confronted with these haters, and that's very painful. And it's really very kind of worrying. So,
yeah,
I guess some people would argue with me, you know, and it was very surprising for me.
Yeah, I suppose that's true. It's me being naive, given how much polarity there is and disagreement in the world. But I guess at the end of the day, all we can do is tell the truth as it appears to us and hope that it's received well. And I don't know, I think personally, I think human beings have a tendency to dwell on the negative, which we are able to overcome. And I'm sure the problem is, for every negative comment, you didn't also get a positive one, because generally the positivity is just people read it and they go, Oh, wow, that's bad, I'm going to do X, or, oh, I know about that now. It's only when people are angry that they write, and I know that from being a filmmaker.
Yeah, but at the same time, I have to say, you know, obviously it was a very rewarding experience, and, you know, all the people that we rescued, you know, thanked us for saving their lives, and I've been in touch with some of them, and really, you know, I've received comments from women telling me that I'm their sister, and, you know, one of the women we rescued, she doesn't really have anyone in Europe, and she told me if I wanted to be a second mother to her child, because she doesn't know anyone. And, you know, and I've received, you know, so many beautiful comments and so much love, and also so much love from the refugee children, you know, who all wanted to hug and to play with us. So really, you know, definitely, you know, receiving those hate comments is nothing compared to what we received, you know, aboard the ship. But it's very sad to see that people, you know, it's really sad to see that when you defend human rights, when you just say, I think all people should have human rights, and nobody should be drowning, and, you know, we all share the same right to live, people still, you know, you would still find trolls who would kind of attack you for your humanitarian work, and that is very sad.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, I think it just is the way it is. I think I say it again, like, all we can do is our best and tell our truth, and that's it. You know, I think it's a big, heavy conversation. It's wine conversation, but we're a tiny little speck in a massive, great big pond. You know, there's billions and billions of people, and if we live with intent and purpose and positively and try to add more to the world than we take away, then that's all we can do, right?
I'm all of a sudden I'm so moved when you said that, because this is actually right before I went on the CI4. I did an interview with a Holocaust survivor, Mr. Weintraub, who is a Polish Jewish survivor, and this is exactly what he said in the interview. And it was so moving as well, because he was saying at the end of the day, you know, and after everything he's been through, he told me in the interview that it's so ridiculous because we are a tiny little, you know, speck of dust, you know, in the universe. And instead of helping each other and kind of living together, we are fighting and, you know, and there's wars and hate, when it's so ridiculous because we are just a little speck in the cosmos and we should all be kind of together.
Yeah.
So that was a very, you know, beautiful interview I did for Minority Rights Group, and with, you know, amazing Mr. Weintraub, and he said exactly the same thing.
Yeah, there's always positivity to be found in anything. Maybe not anything, but most things. I always ask two questions at the end of every conversation. Interpret them however you wish, but what scares you?
What really scared me was the comments I received, not from a personal point of view, because obviously, you know, when you're on the ship and you rescue 400 people, you couldn't care less, but, you know, about an email. But what scared me was that total kind of feeling of being disconnected, you know, from the reality of what I was saying in my stories and you know, and in my interviews from the ship, saying, look, we rescued 400 people in distress. Some of them were dying, some of them were fainting, there were children, some of them, you know, could have died, they were all in a very bad condition, there were babies, you know, our youngest was only 8 months old, and you know, his mother was so afraid for him because he inhaled too much seawater and he was very, very sick. And yet, you know, some people, you know, we can call them trolls or haters or whatever, you know, we want, they still argue with me and say, this is not true and you're a criminal and, you know, you should be in prison. And these people, somebody sent me a message and said that these people are less than monkeys, you know, this is a comment I've received, and that really scares me.
Yeah, I can imagine it does. Okay, and what brings you hope?
What brings me hope is that, you know, when I do this job and I see these incredible people, sometimes you see children or teenagers and all these, you know, old ladies, these babushkas in Ukraine, who have so much kindness and resilience and want to help people and show kindness to people despite what they've been through. And maybe I can end with a story like this from the ship. We rescued at least 5 pregnant women. And one of the pregnant women we rescued, she was, this was on the 16th of May, and we actually rescued her during that night rescue that unfolded between midnight and 3 a.m. So in the middle of the night when everything was pitch black, and our very courageous, you know, rescue team kind of went to this wooden boat and brought 2 pregnant women, because they would usually bring pregnant women and children first. And this lady, obviously, you know, she was soaked in water and she was shaking and she was pregnant. And I tried to kind of show her some support and some kindness, and she didn't speak any English. Like, we could literally just, you know, exchange a few words. And then in the morning, the women and children were sleeping in a kind of a container on board. As she was lying down, I went to check on her because I wanted to make sure she was okay. And then the following morning, I went to check on her again, and she was a bit red, and she looked like she was kind of suffocating inside. So I offered I would help her to sit kind of outside the container. And what was happening was that at that time we were actually finishing off our last rescue. So the deck was full of people, and you know what me and this lady could kind of see and observe was just a deck full of people, you know, and the rescue team and the medic team kind of running, you know, back and forth and across the deck and just putting rescue blankets, you know, on everyone. And this lady started crying, this pregnant lady started crying, and I thought, oh my God, I re-traumatized her. Like, you know, she was just rescued during the night, and now I kind of, you know, I made her kind of come out of the container and watch another group of desperate people, and what have I done? And she was crying, and then she said to me in broken English, she said, you know, I'm crying because I want to help people, I want to do the work that you do, because she was moved. And that gives me hope.
That's a pretty good answer. I'd say that's one of the best answers I've ever had. Well, that was absolutely brilliant. Thank you so much. And we'll leave it there.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thanks for listening. For more information, follow us on Instagram at The Adventure Podcast. The podcast is hosted by Matt Pycroft, is a Cold House production, and is produced and distributed by Orla O'Murray and Alex Hall. If you want to get in touch with feedback or a guest recommendation, or just to say hi, as many people do, then you can email us at info@theadventurepodcast.co.uk.